Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jody Shields, author of The Winter Station, published in January by Little Brown. Jody has also written The Crimson Portrait and the very popular The Fig Eater. She's also a screenwriter and has edited for the New York Times Magazine and American Vogue. So, The Winter Station is set in Carbon in about 1910. Carbon is a kind of wasteland city in a freezing climate in Manchuria, sharing a culture that kind of interweaves Russia and China with this looming presence of the Japanese, wondering what's going to happen and how they can benefit from the situation, which kind of seems confusing, but which actually is explained in the book quite succinctly. So the story is based on a real Manchurian plague. People are dying everywhere. Their deaths are covered up by the autocrat, General Korvat, and others, while the Baron, who's the hero, works with his quirky and sneaky confidant and friend Andreev, and the dwarf, Chang, who deals in the tea ceremony, as well as in providing knowledge to the Baron. The Baron also has a lovely wife, but also rivals like this guy, Dr. Wu, who do not approach the plague with the same type of logic, reason, and goodness as does the Baron. So it's a thriller, a mystery, and it's kind of a true story that Jody weaves into a really readable story that reminds us of the past and makes us think very carefully about our own future. So welcome, Jody, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
So the thing is this is kind of like a true story. So why don't you tell us about how that came about and how you uncovered it when really nobody else had?
Yeah, it is exactly a true story, and I discovered it completely by accident. I was researching in the Academy of Medicine Library, as one does, and I ran across a mention of a book that had been written by a Russian aristocrat who was in Manchuria during a plague epidemic. Of course, I was immediately obsessed, and I happened to find the only copy of the book that was for sale in Germany, had it sent here, had it translated, and then I started writing my book, which was more of an ordeal than I ever anticipated. I needed three translators to help with the research.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I thought of as being a real obstacle, and I might not have the energy to do it, but finding the book and then getting it translated and making sure you had the facts straight. So that must, like I said, that must have been difficult.
Yeah, the research came not only from his book, which was an unusual first-hand account of someone who witnessed a plague, but also newspapers, medical journals, and a lot of chronicles written actually by missionaries who were in China at the time.
Oh, you know, along that line, why don't you talk a little bit, so the readers have a little context. Talk about Manchuria during this time and what I was saying in the introduction about the Chinese and the Japanese.
Yeah, it was a fascinating period around 1910, 1911. It was, you know, pretty just two steps before the Russian Revolution, and the Chinese emperor was deposed. And what happened was that China was a very weak country at this point, and they allowed Russia to build a railroad all the way from Moscow to the Pacific Ocean. And, of course, Russia wanted more than just that. And Japan also wanted Manchuria. So what happened is that you had Russia, Japan, and China. All the armies were circling this town of Harbin, and they were all hoping that each other's armies would become infected by the epidemic and they could conquer the city without a battle. So it was a very volatile situation. The city was full of spies. It was full of people from every country in the world, practically, and there were something like 42 different languages spoken in this town at the time.
Well, then you get to our protagonist, then, the Baron. You know, he's kind of an aristocrat. He's also kind of an innocent. So how did he, from your research, how did he get involved in all this?
Well, he actually was an aristocrat, that's true. His father and his grandfather were diplomats, and And he was a very curious, fascinating person. He spoke Chinese, which is unusual for a Russian, and he was sent to Manchuria when he joined the Imperial Army. And he then stayed on after the war was over and was appointed as the city commissioner. And he became involved, well, the book is structured like a murder mystery. They start finding bodies in the streets, and they don't know what has happened. They wish they didn't know what had happened later on. And he decides to pursue this. And that's what he wrote about in his book. And step by step, he uncovers it, and more people are pulled into a cover-up by the different governments.
And he's like, when I say he's an innocent, he just doesn't understand. He doesn't understand their motives, especially like Dr. Wu and the general. He just doesn't get it.
Exactly. There was one sentence that was translated from the Baron's memoir which really struck me. He said he was sitting by the bedside of a Chinese worker who was dying, and he said, "I realized that this was the last conversation that this man would have on Earth, so I listened very carefully." And when I read that sentence, I was just overwhelmed by his empathy. So unusual for a person who's very wealthy and actually doesn't mix with, you know, lower class people at all. And from that point on, I felt that I had an obligation to tell his story. And his book really came to me like a message in a bottle.
Yeah, and it's like that book by Sinclair Lewis, Arrowsmith. It's like here he is not only being empathetic, but he's exposing himself every day, as are many of the good people in the book, to the possibility of dying himself of the plague.
Yes, but before I started the book, of course, the question that I asked myself was, well, what would I have done? Would I have stayed in the town? Would I have tried to help people? Would I have left? Or would I have survived?
I asked myself the same question.
That's what you ask yourself. I guess I think it's part of the appeal of, you know, The Living Dead, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like, you know, you always think if, you know, there was a little kid in front of an oncoming train, would you jump in front of the train and throw the kid free? And, you know, you always like to think, yeah, that's what I would do, of course, but you don't really know until the moment comes.
I don't think you really get an answer until you're tested, truly.
Correct.
Because human behavior is always surprising, as we found out in the book.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a thought process before. You kind of act instinctively.
Exactly. And I think things just build up, and pretty soon a week goes by, then there's another week. And as time went by and the epidemic picked up steam and more people were ill, it became pretty impossible to leave the town because it was the middle of winter. There are several feet of snow everywhere. It's 30 below zero, and there are no trains.
Yeah, and it's, the other thing is the Baron always seems to be freezing. And like in the middle of the book, I had to get up and turn the heat up in my house because I was, for some reason, I was freezing too. Because you describe it so well, but I was almost thinking like it's so cold, and he's so cold that I feel like I would have left just for that reason.
Exactly. I know. It struck me that way too. I'm reading it and I just thought, oh my God, if only they had Goose Down Parkas back then.
I know, because you walk out into the air and, you know, your nose is frozen, everything's frozen, you have a good chance of getting frostbite. It sounds like a horrible place.
Yes.
In many ways.
Sure. Yeah, well, they were real pioneers that went there. The city was actually called the Paris of the East. It was awash in money, and there were nightclubs. It was quite a place to live, but there was a lot of really, you know, bad behavior.
Well, yeah, that's...
But it must have been very exciting at the same time.
And there's definitely good guys and bad guys. And it's, you know, almost like it is a mystery, but it's almost like a detective story, too. And, you know, how did you create your villains, and did they actually exist in real life, or did you create them without knowing whether or not they...
Well, no, actually, most of the people in the book actually did exist, and my book is pretty true to their character. There were doctors from around the world. You know, there was a global panic about this, so there were doctors from Russia, from China, Japan, France, Great Britain, and they all had different ideas about even how the plague was caused. and how it was spread. Those were the two main points of argument. They never agreed with each other, and so you can imagine the fights they have. And, of course, it was only intensified by the terrible situation when they realized that they were unable to save anyone. But yet, they still stayed there, and they still argued. And the Baron was a whistleblower, and because he stuck up for these people and tried to help them, you know, their passing be less painful, he was pretty ostracized. And, in fact, later on, he was shut out of the medical conferences, and his name was stricken from the records. They vanished him, and he wrote his book, you know, to put himself back on the map.
Yeah, and that reminds me, too, while I was reading it and before I was researching for the interview, I was thinking this kind of really harkens back to Russian authors that I've read, whether it's Chekhov or Tolstoy. And then I read the reviews, and other people say the same thing. Were you consciously trying to create a narrative that sounded like the old Russians? Because it does.
Oh, that's so interesting. I actually wasn't. I was very careful not to use any slang or, you know, forms of language that would identify it as dated. You know, I never said, you know, get lost. And also, I think that the Baron, the main character, also has a kind of formality about him, and somehow that seeped into the text, because I do see that it's a little formal that way. I can't quite describe what I sense it is.
Nor can I. I just had this feeling. It was just the feeling that, okay, I've read this type of literature before, and it was very pleasant to fall back into that because I love it so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So where did Chang and Andreev come from? Because Andreev is an intriguing character that kind of, he interjects comedy into the book.
Yes, he actually did exist. He was, Chang is a dwarf who actually was the doorman at the fanciest department store in the city at the time, which was quite a position of honor. He was very visible. He was one of the best known people in the city. And I was, during my research, strangely, I found another little snippet of information, which was they actually filmed a movie in Harbin in the 1920s, and he actually was in this snippet of film.
Huh.
And
wow.
Which has been lost to history, of course, but I was so delighted to think that somewhere maybe his actual image still exists in black and white somewhere.
And I like the idea that he just ignored his challenge, you know. He didn't, you know, bemoan his fate or anything like that. He just, if he had to hop up onto a chair or hop on somebody's leg to get up onto the chair, he didn't care, and he didn't mind and never dwelled on it.
No, and he had quite a fascinating background. He and Andreev, who was a Russian black marketeer, were two of my favorite characters because they were so unpredictable. And Andreev was a mystery to me. You know, there's some characters you write about and you can't fathom them. I don't know what happened to him at the end of the book, actually. And they were kind of a yin-yang couple. One was, you know, a better character, should we say, than the other one. The other one was motivated by money and, you know, prestige.
But the Baron, you know, Baron thought of him as a friend.
Yes, well, you needed a friend like that. He could cut through red tape. He could get you food that wasn't otherwise available, or fabric, or medical supplies. So you really needed that kind of go-between.
Do you think that like Dr. Wu, do you think that he actually, even though he was, you know, kind of a nasty guy, do you think that those people, from what your research and or just your own thoughts, do you think they actually had in mind the idea that they really wanted to cure this? Or do you think, like the general, they just wanted to cover it up and make it seem as if it wasn't happening there?
Well, they wanted to cover it up. Of course, they all the doctors dreamt of glory and hoped they would find a vaccine or a serum that would cure it, because, of course, there would be glory in that. And when that didn't happen, then they sort of tried to run down the clock, as you were, and cover it up. Dr. Wu was a Chinese doctor. He did not speak Chinese. He was educated in England, and he was appointed, you know, health commissioner of Fort China, and he was barely 30 years old. So here he is trying to cure the plague with doctors from Western countries who completely didn't respect him because he was so young and had no experience, and yet he was in charge. So the situation was traumatic for everyone.
Yeah, you couldn't have made up the story. The fact that the Chinese guy doesn't speak Chinese and the Russian guy does speak Chinese, and what we haven't talked about is the fact that, you know, he has what I consider to be this lovely wife too. Talk a little bit about her.
Yes. Well, it was really my pleasure to research the daily life in China. So, in addition to all the medical stuff, the book also has a great deal of information about food and customs, tea ceremonies. The reading material, it was so wonderful to read about this. And the Baron himself, who did speak Chinese, also practices calligraphy. And I did become completely fascinated by it. I had no idea it was, I'm going to say poetic, but when you're learning calligraphy, they describe the way you learn, and it's completely in metaphors. It's a sort of a mind over matter over your hand. It was, I'd never read anything like it. I was just so fascinated.
Yeah, it was so mystical, and the way in which his day would then be reflected in the way and the how well he was able to practice it. It was like Zen and the Art of Archery. It's not about the target, you know.
Yes, exactly.
And
as they said, the mind does not control the brush. The hand does not control the mind.
Yeah, that was really excellent because even though you may have discovered it just in your reading, you wove it really well into the actual storyline.
Well, he needed a relief when he would come home. You know, in the middle of an epidemic or a crisis, you still pursued the small things of life that anchor you to better times.
Well, you know, and one of the reviews said that his wife was subservient to him, but I didn't really think that she is. She,
well, I mean, at that time, remember, Chinese women couldn't even go outside by themselves. You weren't allowed to walk around in the street alone if you were a Chinese woman. So how could she, women, Chinese women in general, were subservient? That's completely historically accurate.
Yeah,
but she, no, I didn't think she was.
And you know, she wanted to go to the party, and she did. You know.
Yes.
And
she was, in a way, kind of the power behind the throne.
True. Yeah, very true.
She again was a character I couldn't really fathom her at all either. She remained a mystery to me.
Yeah, and she remained a mystery in the book too. But you still learned a lot about her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was fascinated with her, and like I said, all the corollary characters were drawn so well that, you know, I'll probably remember their names forever. But and that's what happens when you read Russian literature too. You remember names. Or when you read something like by Ayn Rand or something like that, you remember the names of the people in the books. And mm-hmm. I think that's a sign of, you know, good.
Yeah, writing. I sort of miss the characters, actually.
Yeah. I ask this to a lot of authors. How do you feel like when this book came out, do you feel like, you know, you're letting go of your firstborn? I mean, you've done this before in your previous books, but do you feel like you're kind of letting go of them? Do you welcome the reader interpreting what you wrote in perhaps a different way than you meant it to be? Because I guess when you go to book mm-hmm. signings, you hear all kinds of questions.
Well, I feel as if I just haven't seen the characters for a while. They're still out there somewhere. I just haven't seen them for a while. It's like they're traveling.
Uh-huh.
But I still feel that they're present. It's a curious thing because people, they would read the book and they would say, oh, I'm on page da-da-da, and this just happened. And I wouldn't remember what I had written, but I would remember the visual picture of what they had described, as if I'd seen a film, and I was just rolling it back to that particular scene. It's an odd thing.
It is a very cinematic book. And when you are a screenwriter, so have you thought about that?
Oh, I've thought about it, but I think I need a break.
Well, I hope it's not for too long. It was definitely, you know, like I said, I have an independent bookstore, and it's definitely on the front table. And yeah, and it has a great cover too, which,
yes, the cover is so wonderful. I was so thrilled, I have to say.
Yeah, I was just talking to another author, actually the woman who wrote Under the Tuscan Sun, and she had a great cover for her new book. And you know, again, having a bookstore, everyone always tells you, you know, you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my store does exactly that.
And, interesting. And yeah, with the paperback edition of The Fig Eater, because the woman's dress was orange,
yep,
they said people are attracted to it immediately.
And that's why publishers don't let authors pick covers generally, because they want to sell books and they know how covers work.
I don't argue with them anymore. Well, exactly.
Yeah, I guess they give you a couple to vet, but in any event, you know, I think they picked a good one. It's certainly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, yeah, it was a great book, and thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the only thing I would like to add is I love libraries.
Oh, great.
Any excuse I have to go and sit in a library and open a book that has that sort of musty old odor is a thrill for me.
That's the first thing I usually do when I go to New York City. Is go to the library.
Yes.
I go to the library and then I go to St. Pat's just because I like the feeling.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, go to the American Academy of Medicine next time. It's an incredible library.
Okay, I will.
Fifth and Fifth Avenue.
Okay, that's right where I usually am. Well, thanks again.
Oh, thank you, Sam, very much.
We were talking with Jody Shields. She just wrote Winter Station, and she wrote the very popular The Fig Eater, which I think I read, but I'm not quite 100% sure. But in any event, this is a really good mystery kind of thriller novel, but you wouldn't think that it would be when you first read it or first start reading it. And then it becomes a story about the plague in Manchuria in 1910. Anyway, it was a very good book. I really highly recommend it. And then coming up, we have Matt Young, who's going to talk about his memoir, which has gotten a lot of press and buzz about the Iraqi war. It's called Eat the Apple. And then Andrew Santella joins us to share his really funny new book, Soon, An Overdue History of Procrastination. And the funniest thing is that he postponed our interview. So it's like when you go to the door of the Procrastinators Club, there's a sign on it that says postponed until tomorrow. So it was so funny that he admits that he's a procrastinator, and he postponed our interview. So in any event, we have him and other men and women coming soon for spring and summer. We're kind of booked up. And as I've told you before, I love doing this. You know, I've been interviewing now for probably 7 or 8 years, and having talked to over 400 authors, it's one of the most pleasant things I've been able to do, talk to people whose books I really love and learn about them and learn about the motivation behind the book and the characters in those books. So once again, thank you as always, and we look forward to having you here next week on The Avid Reader.